Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Hey, everyone, I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the podcast where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kyle Risdahl. It is Tuesday, which means a deep dive into a single topic. And today's inspired by a lot of things, right? Number one, the climate. Number two, the UN climate report. Number three, the climate. And number four, the climate, because it's getting hotter and it's bad. And so we're going to talk today the corporate side of that and the business case for addressing and taking on what I think Molly and I agreed the other day, we're going to start calling the climate crisis, actually.
Yes, definitely, because it is, as evidenced most recently. I mean, any of the days we did this story, there could have been a related story. Most recently, there's been the flooding in Tennessee, a landlocked state that killed, I think, over 20 people. And that, you know, reporting indicates was made much worse by the climate crisis. And increasingly, activists have been saying for years, we need to 10x, 100x the money, the investment that is going into reducing greenhouse gases and our use of fossil fuels. A number of companies have incorporated what are known as ESG goals into their business strategies. We'll talk about that later in the show, environment, social, and governance goals. But are the commitments real? Are they making a difference? And will it make a difference if more companies get in the game in a meaningful way? We're going to try to answer those questions in our deep dive today. And our guest has been thinking and acting on this topic a lot.
And having some success, we have to say. Michael O'Leary is a managing director at the investment firm Engine Number One. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because you heard it probably on Marketplace and a bunch of other places. Because a couple of months ago, they won three seats on the board of directors at ExxonMobil. And with that, have basically forced the company to address more head-on its role in climate change and the climate crisis. He's also an author. His book is called Accountable, The Rise of Citizen Capitalism. Michael, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right, so no pressure, but the first question is a biggie. How do you frame the success you had with ExxonMobil in the larger fight against the climate crisis?
Now, it's sobering to remember. You know, you pointed out the floods in Tennessee. It's sobering to remember that we are currently living in better than the best case scenario for what could happen to our climate over the next century. Net zero isn't the best option, it's the only option. I mean, if we cut emissions only in half, carbon dioxide levels wouldn't drop, they'd just rise less quickly. And so I think you're right, that it should be framed as the climate crisis and the sort of action that we're all gonna need to take at a government level, at a corporate level, at an investor level, needs to be able to match that moment. What we did with Exxon was we were able to point out at a company that for the most part had stuck its head in the sand on environmental issues. They're the fifth largest greenhouse gas emitter. While two-thirds of its business comes from countries that have already committed to going net zero. And as late as last October, the CEO was still dismissing the suggestion that climate change posed long-term risk to the industry by calling net zero targets a beauty competition. So all of this created an opportunity for us to come along as shareholders, as investors, and say, ExxonMobil, the current strategy, the current leadership is not poised for success in what's going to be happening to our climate, what's happening to our world. They need new leadership. And we made the case very strongly that environmental issues, in this case, are ultimately economic issues, and other shareholders agreed.
Right. Tell us a little more. Let's dig into that business case that you were able to make, because ExxonMobil, you know, certainly has been more than on the sidelines, I would say, right? Actively impeding efforts to transition away from fossil fuels.
Oh, absolutely.
And have made a lot of money.
Right. I mean, you look at a couple of different analysts, you know, from places like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, other industry groups have tried to estimate the amount of investment it's going to take across the world to try and limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And the numbers you get are somewhere in the range of $40, $50, $60 trillion over the next 40 years, that we're going to have to fundamentally transform the way we generate power, the way we grow food, how we build our cities, how we heat our homes, and how we get around. And you take a look at that context and think about what sorts of long-term investment decisions should a company like Exxon be making today, knowing that the world is going to have to transform to meet the demands of the climate crisis. You say, if you are trying to survive in that world, you need a leadership at the top, be board members who oversee the company, who understand that transition. And when we launched our campaign, there was not a single board member who had energy experience. And so our goal was, can we put new leadership in place that understand that succeeding over the long term as an energy company, as any company today, requires having a strategy that understands the world is going to decarbonize. There's no other option. That the position we're in now is fundamentally transforming almost every industry is less risky, less costly than not doing so because of what could happen to our climate. And Exxon needed board leadership that understood that and was willing to make the investments, the long-term investments at Exxon, that would diversify its business away from just extracting oil and gas forever.
With the understanding that, you or your representatives, actually, are you going to take one of the three board seats?
We are not, no. So we nominated four other directors, all of whom had deep energy experience, but all of whom on the side of how energy needs to transform going forward.
Okay, so with the understanding that, your representatives your proposed slate is going to have to sit in the same room with Exxon directors who have been there for a very long time espousing non-climate-friendly policies, what do you make of the fact that the company spent tens of millions of dollars fighting to keep you off the board?
I think with the approach we have to take with Exxon, with every company, is that the biggest risk right now is that we'll win this battle of ideas, this battle of rhetoric, but we'll lose the war of substantive action. And so if you ask CEOs generally, you know, do you think it's important for the company to reposition itself around climate change? Do you think it's important for a company to serve its stakeholders? 9 out of 10 will say yes. The problem is if you then ask them, are you satisfied with the job your company is doing? 96% will say, yes, we're already doing a great job. And so what we needed was leadership in the boardroom who had the experience to be able to call out when the assumptions Exxon was making did not align with reality. Because ultimately, if you think about it, if you're running one of these energy companies today, your key job is understanding which major multi-billion dollar projects should we be investing in going forward. And making those decisions relies on having a set of assumptions about what the world will look like 5, 10, 20, 50 years from today, including what demand for oil and gas will look like. And our argument all along was that the assumptions they were making were not economic. They were not realistic, given what the goals of countries, of other companies, of citizens were, and that making those decisions, those investment decisions, better required understanding what was happening with our climate.
Right. So the idea is not that these three board members are going to come in and be the hippies in the room saying you need to do the right thing. They're the people who know the energy business, see the energy transition, are like, hey, China just kicked cryptocurrency out of its country because of, you know, the power use. Everything is changing. Believe the data.
Ultimately, I think if we had made a purely environmental argument, kind of a save the polar bears argument on why we need a new leadership at Exxon, I don't think we've been successful. I don't think we had to make the economic argument, the argument that this is what was best for the long term of the company. And that's how, you know, you have to remember, companies, public companies are run like little republics. Shareholders elect boards, boards appoint CEOs, CEOs then execute strategy. And so our right as investors is to nominate and vote for which directors are going to represent us. So our task always with this was we put forward a board slate, a set of four new directors that we thought could better guide the direction of Exxon into the future. And then we had to spend 6 months convincing other shareholders that our slate was better than the incumbents.
So who's doing it right? Of the big companies out there, who's doing it right?
Then you have to look at, you know, which companies are leading into the transition, into the transformation that's going to be required to meet the demands of climate change. One I would point to right now is a lot of the big auto companies. GM, for instance, under the leadership of Mary Barra, the CEO, made the announcement, the bold announcement at the beginning of this year, that they were going to go all electric in their fleet by 2035. That, if you think about the auto sector, the last time there was that sort of transformation was back in the early 20th century when they were deciding on what the core drivetrain, you know, how were we going to power these vehicles in the first place? And so making that sort of goal, that target, tying herself and all of GM to the mast, that they're going to be able to achieve that, I think that's the level of commitment and transformation that ultimately is going to have to happen across nearly every industry. And it's going to be, in some cases, easier. In some ways, you look at the technology around solar, wind, electric vehicles, electric heat pumps. There's some technologies that are already nearly there in terms of the economic case for consumers, for companies. But it's going to come to every industry, even ones that are hard to decarbonize, like aviation or shipping or concrete or steel. Ultimately, if we want to hold global warming to 1.5 degrees, we're going to have to decarbonize each and every one of these industries. And the question for companies is who's going to lead and who's going to fall behind.
One thing I think is interesting, speaking of those automakers, is yes, that is a big, bold, transformative change that also comes at a time when, for example, car ownership is declining. You could argue that automakers, you know, again, I mean, economics are going to drive so much of this. Automakers are in a position where they are going to need people to buy new cars, and there are going to be incentives, tax incentives for them to buy electric vehicles, maybe even tax incentives for these companies to build electric vehicles, that it all becomes this sort of virtuous cycle of incentives for them to make the transition economically.
Well, I think there's this common misconception that somehow addressing climate change is merely philanthropic from companies. Ultimately, these companies are recognizing that environmental issues are economic issues, and that exactly as you said, government policy that subsidizes certain technologies or taxes certain types of pollution, as consumer demand shifts, as supply chains shift, the best argument for transformation is in many ways the simplest, which is what's the alternative? The world is changing, and the companies like GM can either recognize that they need to transform as well, or allow that companies like Tesla and a long tail of small electric vehicle companies is going to own the future of auto. I think they're making the right call in transformation.
So you alluded to government there just a little bit, right, with tax incentives and all of that thing. But I mean, we need to be plain here, right? Corporate America cannot do this by itself, nor can government do it by itself, right?
That's right. That's right. And one area we can see this clearest is with disclosure, for instance. Right now, if you're a public company, there's all sorts of disclosures you need to make on your financial and operational metrics. Right now, financial reporting is overseen by GAAP and the SEC and all these accounting firms. But when it comes to things like carbon emissions or the diversity of your workforce or the amount of land you use, these are not yet required. And so that's one area where quite clearly government can get involved in requiring greater standardized reporting, particularly on emissions. Another area is, you know, technology takes a long time to develop. It can be very expensive to develop. And especially in its infancy, having subsidies from government can be helpful. So something like electric solar voltaics, wind power, costs have come down 90% in the last decade. In those early years, it can require subsidies, taxes to make that sort of technology economic, even if in the long term, it is by far cheaper to use photovoltaics than it is to use oil and gas. It takes time to get there.
Let's take a step back and talk a little bit more broadly about this idea of ESG investing, environmental, social, and governance goals that companies have and that are increasingly reporting requirements for companies. So they're ending up with these big pots of money that in some ways they have to spend on environmental, social, and governance issues, right? Like, how much is that driving some of these investments that companies are making, even if they don't totally know what they're doing yet?
That's right. That's right. I think in many ways, when we talk about what's gone wrong with capitalism or when there's critiques of capitalism, oftentimes we misdraw the battle lines where we frame it as shareholders versus the climate or shareholders versus stakeholders. When in reality, 50% of Americans own stock. 137 million people in this country have stock in public companies. For a vast majority of them, their interests are in a long-term sustainable future where the economy grows in inclusive ways and environmentally friendly ways. And that recognition is what's powering this ESG movement. So today, there's something like $17 trillion across the world that's invested in what are called ESG funds. So oftentimes, these are investment funds that exclude certain sectors like oil and gas or try and invest in companies that are more environmentally or socially friendly. Same thing on the debt side. There's green bonds now. Companies can raise debt specifically for sustainability projects. The divestment movement, I'm sure you guys have heard of. There's now $14 trillion of investors who have committed to divesting their portfolios from fossil fuels. And all of these trends are pushing towards ultimately the same goal, which is how do we use our power as shareholders to try and push and cajole and require companies to do the things that we actually think is in our best long-term interests, even as shareholders, which often means doing the things that are more responsible, more environmentally friendly, more attuned to climate change.
So do you suppose that it's possible that look, I don't want to be a downer here, but you get three seats on Exxon's board and lots of hoopla and you made all kinds of press. What if this doesn't work? What if this is as far as you got? What if this is the high watermark?
Ultimately, our work is just beginning. As a firm with Exxon, in many ways, we're in the early days of this broader ESG movement where we're still kind of the exponential part of the growth curve. And as a result, we're seeing a lot of different strategies being tried. You know, is it better to exclude these companies from your portfolio to try and punish them? Is it better to engage with them to nominate directors? Is it better to try and regulate them? I think you look at the demands of climate change and it's an all hands on deck requirement. We need to try everything from our roles as consumers, as employees, as investors, as innovators, as voters. We need to try everything. And ultimately, one thing I take heart in is that our decisions determine what our economy looks like. Our economy is ultimately a reflection of the decisions that each of us individually makes. And to the extent that we, through our power of our votes, through the power of our investment dollars, can change the incentives, can push companies to act in a different way, I think it gives me great hope that there's a way to build an economy that is better attuned, better reflects our values, and is more prepared for climate change.
What are, before we let you go, what are some of the things that you think would create real accountability in addition to sort of a board by board upset and, you know, ESG metrics? Yesterday, we talked on the show a little bit about how the Fed could potentially take a stronger approach in terms of classifying the climate crisis as a financial risk, or conversations about things like a carbon tax. Like, what do you think needs to happen on the broad scale to create accountability so that we don't see a short-term surge in greenwashing?
We think a lot about the investor point of view. What can investors be doing in this movement? And part of that is investors need information to make decisions. Right now, many investors are flying blind. They don't know what carbon emissions different companies have, how different companies are exposed to climate change in different ways. So I think one easy systemic fix would be requiring greater disclosure from every company, standardizing it, auditing it, making it so that every investor before they invest understands the risks and the opportunities at each company. Ultimately, our economy has transformed before, can transform again, but given the sort of capitalist society we live in, it's going to require capitalists, it's going to require shareholders to be part of that movement, if not leading it.
Michael O'Leary is managing director at Engine Number One, the investment firm that just won three seats on ExxonMobil's board, and co-author of the book Accountable: The Rise of Citizen Capitalism. Michael, thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Yeah. Also, I can't believe we spent so much time trying to figure out what to rename capitalism to. And then there was Michael with his book, Citizen Capitalism. That's perfect. Remember, we were like, moral capitalism, stakeholder capitalism.
Yeah.
Citizen oh, yeah. Capitalism. Citizen. Like that. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Works out all right. Works out yep. all right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Love this. I mean, I think it's really, I think there are plenty of people who are going to say capitalism is the problem, not the solution to the problem. I think there's a compelling counter argument to be made that this is the system we have. Let's use it.
Right.
And
right.
I would like to know what you guys think. Give us your gut check. Are you half full, half empty on ESGs and board takeovers as a way to tackle the climate crisis? We want to hear what you think.
Nice little brand extension right there. Nice little brand extension. Working that half
right?
full, half empty thing in. You can send us a voice memo or an email, makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can just pick up the phone and call us. Leave us a voice message. Our new number is 508-827-6278, 508-UB-SMART. Dial it and talk to us and see what happens. We'll be right back.
See, didn't we tell you we'd be right back? We're back. I know sometimes you worry when we go away, just like the dogs do. Oh, but we're back, and it's time for the news picks. Look at Kai with all the links today.
All these links. Sorry, I was just laughing at myself, laughing at you. I'm so amused by us sometimes, and I hope I don't come off as a jerk because of that.
Just a couple dorks, basically, just like every good podcast duo.
All right. So I took a page out of Molly Wood's playbook today, and I went with three links, all of which have a theme, which I will get to in my last link. Theme number one, which is the theme of the program today, and I'm going to quote the headline out of the Wall Street Journal today. U.S. crops wither under scorching heat, right? We are getting less yield from our crops because the climate is changing, and we have something like 7.8 billion mouths to feed on this planet. That is a very, very bad thing. That is item number one. Item number two, also from the Wall Street Journal. Delta variant outbreaks in sparsely vaccinated Asian countries disrupt production. You read into that article, and it talks about factory output in Vietnam being down because they don't have enough vaccines to get all their factory workers vaccinated, so they have to shut down the factories, which, of course, will result in a supply shock, which is what got us here in March of 2020 when we all said, oh, my God, Apple factory in China, and we don't have enough stuff to buy. So that's problem number two. And then finally, this one is in the category of capitalism does not care if you live or die. Stocks are up today. S&P 500 is going to close at a record, and the NASDAQ is going to break 15,000.
Oh, wow. I guess in March, the stocks were tanking. But yes, yeah. Yep, there we are.
So
stocks are doing fine. Here's what I don't – why aren't companies – I know that there is this huge push to get – governments, including the government of the United States, to, for example, maybe not give everybody in America a third shot, but try to get the rest of the world vaccinated. Why do we think companies are not doing that? Like, why isn't Adidas and Crocs, like the companies that are mentioned in this article as doing a lot of manufacturing in Vietnam, buying a bunch of vaccine and giving it to their workers?
Great question. And I do not know the answer. Yeah, totally.
Couldn't they be doing that?
If you run the Nike factory in Vietnam, send yourself over 30,000 vaccines. Yeah, totally. I don't know.
Right.
Can private companies buy? I guess they can just buy them.
I mean, that leads us into this deep, dark question of how they're treating those workers in the first place. But seriously, though, if you want your business to succeed in the coming year or two or however long this pandemic lasts, because it's going to be a long time, because what did somebody say on Twitter? What doesn't kill you mutates and tries again. Like, maybe make vaccines part of your business strategy?
Yeah.
I don't know. Just thinking. I was sort of similarly fascinated by this question of cryptocurrency and its environmental impact. You heard me mention it in the interview that China has quite specifically booted the cryptocurrency industry, cryptocurrency mining from huge, you know, parts of the country. Like a lot of mining companies had been in Mongolia and other parts of China where energy was really inexpensive, because you may recall that you need like banks and banks and banks of computers to do millions and millions and millions and trillions of math problems to verify every transaction on the blockchain. And if you successfully verify one in this weird like math lottery, then you make a Bitcoin. Yay! It takes a lot of computing power. So that means you are incentivized to find cheap electricity. So Inner Mongolia, Xinjiang, and then Sichuan and Yunnan have been big hubs for cryptocurrency. And China was like, hey, turns out In addition to our really good privacy laws that we now have, we also have incredibly ambitious goals around reducing coal use and, quote, recasting China as a climate champion, says the Wall Street Journal. So now all these mining companies are trying to figure out where to go. And some U.S. states that have moribund coal industries, mm-hmm. or, you know, big reserves of natural gas are like, oh, come here and pollute. That'd be great.
Come on,
we'll give you
over.
Cheap energy. We'll give you cheap fossil fuel energy to mine Bitcoin. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Holy cow. Like, things are getting kind of topsy-turvy in the world. And this is just one fascinating example. Also, just crazy the logistics times. Of moving all these mining rigs is really interesting because it's like super sensitive equipment and it costs a lot. Shipping costs a lot right now because you can't find a container.
Yeah.
It's just a really, I mean, if you're a nerd like me, this is a really interesting read.
There you go. There you
that's
go.
That's it. Boom. Right. Time for the news. That's it for the news fix. We're done. That's it. That's all the links. Let's do the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
So we had Amy Cuddy on the show last week. She is a social psychologist, and she was talking about pandemic flux syndrome, all the anxiety people are having as we're kind of getting out of it, but not really, going back to the office, but not really. Heard from a lot of people, including Livia from Atlanta. Here's what she says. I was listening on my morning commute and trying to deal with the dread that seems to happen every time I have to go into the office. Is it normal to be nearly in tears? Asking for a friend. Where I work, the big disconnect seems to arise from senior leadership wanting to get back to the way things were and everyone else wanting to forge a new path forward. I work at a place with mostly older, white senior leadership, so I wonder if they just don't have the exposure to how this has gone for different populations. And on top of this, of course, we are expected to do more with less since we are short-staffed. Man, there was a lot in that email, Olivia. Holy cow. Wow.
I mean, this email is like the microcosm of... the whole thing, the syndrome, America's response, corporate America's response, why everybody's quitting their jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, all of that. Yes. So to answer the simplest part of it, it is super normal to be nearly in tears all the time, at least reporting from one friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think the demographic of corporate leadership is perhaps at odds with the demographic of some of the employees, maybe even most in some companies. And I think that's a real challenge. And heck yeah, more with less since we're short staffed and people have to take, and as we've talked about on Marketplace, and I think on this podcast as well, people are taking advantage of the changes brought by this pandemic to actually change what they're doing with their lives. And that's a real thing, too, for sure.
You know, I think that senior leadership question might be a little underexplored. That is a really good point. Early in the pandemic, we talked about how, or at least I think I said I was hopeful that now that all these working men in America had to be at home with their kids and sort of see all of the things that happen in a household, see maybe the emotional labor that women were doing in some of these households, that there might be more empathy. And by and large, I think we saw that in some families. Certainly, some of our listeners reported that, but we sort of didn't see as much of that from senior leadership at some companies as I would have expected. And I am not sure what that's about.
Yeah, look, I totally agree. And I think also, for as much as you and I bring it up on the pod and we talk about it in Marketplace, I think the stress and the this is a strong word, but the professional destruction that this pandemic has brought to women has kind of faded from the headlines. Right. It was hot there for a while. Right. December, January, when we had that jobs report where 800,000 women left the workforce and they were all of the lost jobs and everything. That was big. But, you know, squirrel. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
absolutely. I'm going to repeat the tweet I saw and I'm going to find the original one. But there was a story or a tweet that said what we discovered in this pandemic is that other countries have a social safety net and the U.S. has women.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. 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 Yep.
For sure. I sort of want that on a really angry looking T-shirt.
Yeah. How does the t-shirt look angry?
P.S.
Anyway.
19 U.S. states have never had a female governor. Headline I saw earlier today.
Yeah.
Okay. We also got, let's keep, you know, your comments. Let's stick to your comments. We got this voicemail from Cody in Washington.
I'm an emergency nurse, and I'm not seeing things get back to normal at all. In fact, I haven't seen anything this bad in 14 years of working in emergency departments. Our ICU is completely filled to capacity with very sick COVID patients who are all younger than they were before. My colleagues have done codes in hallways and waiting rooms because every available room is in isolation. People are frustrated that they can't be seen because hospitals are so overextended. We're so tired. So I don't understand this disconnect when I hear about the tail of the pandemic and things getting back to normal. Things aren't getting back to normal for us. They're getting worse. I'm sorry to take us to the dark place. Your show really does bring me a lot of smiles and laughs on the way home from work each day, and I really thank you guys for that. Take care.
Well.
Yeah.
That last bit, I'm glad for that last bit where we're helping.
I am too, but man. I mean, this is the new civilian-military divide in some ways
our
country.
Good analogy.
We are not.
Good analogy.
Right? Like the healthcare workers are doing all of this, taking care of people who don't even want it, and then trying to take care of people who do. Mm-hmm. And we have no idea. And I don't understand why a story like this isn't leading every broadcast every day. Cody, thanks for your service.
Kathy, Virginia, go ahead.
I work at a public university, Norfolk State University. And we were the first university to say every employee and student must be vaccinated in this area. And now we're back to mask mandates indoors. So we're getting ready to meet and greet everybody for the beginning of the semester, and we're going into full face-to-face meetings. Some people aren't too happy about it. Some are. I'm looking forward to it, and I'm actually looking forward to not having to talk through a video screen to my students. So thanks for the show. One of my faves. All right. Bye.
Yeah. Get vaxxed. Wear a mask inside. Let's be safe.
Yeah.
Right? It's the name of the game.
Yep. Yep. All right, now we're going to leave you with, by the way, thank you, everybody who called and emailed us. Like, this one really, why wouldn't it? It is a shared experience for all of us, really hit a nerve, that episode, and we're grateful for all that you're going through out there and for the fact that you're listening to us still. And now we're going to leave you with this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about?
Hi, this is Sabrina from Portland, Oregon. I wanted to share something that I thought I knew, but later found out I was wrong about. When I was raising my kids and they were very young, I thought that by the time they were ready to go to college, I would be ready to send them, that I was going to be done. And especially after a year and a half of being stuck in the same house with each other, I was going to be so ready to send them off. But I'm not. My daughter left for college last Monday. She's launched and she's loving it. I'm really sad. I miss her desperately. And I've learned how important she's been in my life, and I'm glad that I still have her.
That is a long drive home, dropping that kid off at school. Let me just tell you that. I've only got two more of those to go. And Ms. Wood, you've got that to look forward to.
I can't even. I'm like weeping already just thinking about it. I read ahead in this letter. I was like, don't listen to this voicemail. You're just going to cry, and I am. God.
Yeah,
our
it's
babies.
Really hard. It's really hard. It's really
Speaking
hard.
Of going to college, oh, my gosh. I mean, I just... Oh, it's too much. It's too close. All right. Speaking of going to college, last week, longtime listener shared his experience with paying for college with his twin sons, including using a 529 plan. A lot of you wrote in with some 529 tips of your own. It is a good time to remind you all, we're not actual experts. You should definitely talk to financial experts. There's a lot of good research on the internet as well, but it is complicated. There are a lot of special circumstances to consider. We love, however, when listeners help each other get smart. Just know this is not official advice.
That is correct.
Even though we think we know it all.
So if you got something to say, you can say it to us on the phone, 508-82-SMART or 508-UB-SMART. You can also email us or send us a voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org.
I love that the producers keep making you say UB-SMART.
I know, right?
It's like my new fave. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Well done, Marissa. Well played. Tony Wagner writes our newsletter, and our intern, who is delightful, is Grace Rubin.
Today's program was engineered by Juan Carlos Torrado. Charlton Thorpe's going to mix it down later. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Donna Tam was back in the senior producer chair today. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. And there we go. And there we go. Well, there was a lot in that episode, I'll tell you what.
There really was a lot in there.
There kind of was. Not sure I was ready for that. I was ready for that much.
I'm a mess over here.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.